From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the latest on the deadly shooting in Thousand Oaks, California.
It's a horrific scene in there. There is blood everywhere, and the suspect is part of that.
Also today, Eric Fernstrom, former top aide to Senator-elect Mitt Romney, talks about Romney's future in the Senate and the current state of both major parties in the wake of the midterm elections.
Donald Trump owns the Republican Party.
And countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo wants to take opera mainstream.
Our audiences are there. They just don't know that they would like opera, but they're people who like beautiful things.
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. 13 people are dead after a late-night shooting at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California, a town about 40 miles west of Los Angeles. This morning, Ventura County Sheriff Jeff Dean described what the bar looked like in the wee hours.
It's a horrific scene in there. There is blood everywhere, and the suspect is part of that.
Sheriff Dean identified the suspect as 28-year-old Ian David Long, who allegedly entered the bar with a .45-caliber handgun around 11:20 p.m. local time. Among the victims is Sheriff Sergeant Ron Helis, a 29-year veteran of the department. He was just a year away from retirement. Witnesses told CBS Los Angeles that there were about 200 people in the bar at the time that the shooting started.
And then all of a sudden, you hear like the bang-bang of the gunshot, and it just started going crazy. Like, everyone just dropped down to the floor, and then we couldn't get out because the shooting was on that side. So then our friends got the bar stools, and they started slamming it against the window so we could get out.
We're going to spend some time today talking about the effects of these mass shootings on our civil society. And listeners, as we do that, we want to hear from you. How are you reacting to the news of this latest one, coming less than 2 weeks after a shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where a gunman killed 11 people? Do shootings like this make you rethink going to church or temple? What about a bar or a public concert? And if so, do you worry about what that means for us as a society? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. And let's begin with a report from Thousand Oaks. At the teen center there in California in Thousand Oaks is Katie Zesma. She's my former neighbor in the Washington Post newsroom, and she's a national correspondent for the Post. Katie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Cal. Thanks for having me.
Just begin, Katie, if you would, by describing the scene in Thousand Oaks right now. What's going on? What are you seeing?
So right now I'm outside the teen center, and it's where families are being notified. And it is just a heartbreaking scene. People are crying and being consoled. They're being notified here as to whether a family member was killed or not inside the bar. So it's just absolutely heartbreaking. You're seeing people, you know, learning that their loved ones were just killed, and they're praying, they're consoling each other, as they're learning this news.
We have some tape from a father who's in exactly the situation you're describing there, Katie. His name is Jason Kaufman, and here he is talking about his son, who he says was inside the Borderline Bar and Grill when the shooting took place.
You all know that I was been here fighting for him all morning long. And we did just get the news that he was one of the 11 that were killed last night.
Tell us his name.
His name was Cody Kaufman. My firstborn son. Oh, son, I love you so much. Oh, heaven.
And Katie, earlier today, Mr. Kaufman was telling reporters that he was using an app to track his son's phone. He could see that it was still in the bar and not moving. And Katie, I think as parents, we can only imagine what he's going through.
Absolutely. And I was there when he spoke, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. He could barely speak. You know, he spoke, he and Cody were best friends, he said, and he coached the baseball team, and they went fishing, and he has two, he leaves behind two very young brothers and a sister who is due to be born at the end of the month.
Katie, I understand that the suspected gunman, Ian David Long, was among the 13 found dead at the scene. What have we learned about him in the hours since the shooting?
He was. The police said, the sheriff's department said earlier this morning that they believe he may have killed himself. What we know about him is that he was in the Marine Corps. We know that he had prior contact with police earlier this year. The police came to his home to check on his well-being to see if he may, be taken in a 5150 hold, which here in California means that you can be taken into protective custody if you're a danger to yourself or others. And the people on the scene decided that he did not fit that criteria, so he was not taken in for that hold. He said other very, very minor interactions with law enforcement. They said, speed as a car accident and a traffic infraction. So that is what we know. That is what we know of him so far. And obviously, we'll learn a lot more today.
And Katie, what have authorities said might happen next in the investigation? What kind of questions are still outstanding in your mind?
I think most of them are outstanding. They don't know the motive yet. They don't know what caused him to do this, why he chose this bar. That is all things, a very, very active investigation, and that's all things that the authorities are trying to figure out right now.
All right, that's Katie Zesma, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So there's still a lot we don't know about this particular mass shooting, but one of the things that stands out to us today at Radio Boston is this idea. Do shootings like this one have you rethinking the way that you interact in public spaces? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. It's that very question we began talking about this morning, posed by our own Radio Boston producer, Zoe Mitchell, and she joins us in the studio. Hi, Zoe.
Hey, Callum.
Can you just give us a little sense of what your thought process was? We have another one of these awful headlines as we all wake up this morning, and what was sort of the question that was running through your head?
So after reading the news this morning and hearing that report and that those families is devastating, but I was thinking kind of about how, in these past 2 weeks alone, we've seen coverage of these shootings at a house of worship in Pittsburgh, a yoga studio in Florida, and now a bar, in California. And it's just kind of piling on to the places that, I feel like I can't go or we can't go and feel safe anymore. On Tuesday, someone I follow on Twitter was writing about her polling place and a folding table there collapsed in this crowded room. And she said that noise startled everyone to think, someone was there shooting up the polling place. And it just piles on in a way, and it's something that shouldn't happen. And, after today, I feel like now it's like another place I can't go. It just adds to that list. Like I can't even go to a bar and enjoy a drink with my friends. It's something I would love to do, on weekends. And I can't do that anymore and feel safe.
Well, I think the polling place anecdote is so timely. And we have a caller who's sort of speaking to that point. Ashley from Watertown is calling in. And Ashley, I understand that you had second thoughts about voting on Tuesday for fear of this very reason.
For taking my call, that was one of the first things that went through my mind. Was I told my husband, I said, it'd be good if I could vote earlier, cast a mail-in ballot, because I'm worried about what might happen on Thursday. Something crazy could happen, and it was just crazy. That's the type of society we live in, where I have to think that, and it's true. Anytime we have some national event, I have to go, oh, what crazy is going to come out of the woodwork. And I just had my first child about 5 months ago, and, I was telling the person who answered the phone, this is the type of stuff I'm going to have to teach her. I'm going to have to teach her to think about these things. Like, well, when you go to vote, you might have to, it'd be safer to do mailing because you never know. And it's like, I just can't believe, I also teach other children, and I went to go teach them, and their mom had the I voted sticker on, and she said, oh, it'd be good. I took my kids so they can see. And I thought, yeah, I have memories of going to vote with my mom and getting the I voted sticker. I don't know if I'm going to have that with my child, because I'm going to have to tell her to do a mail-in voting because I'm scared for her to walk into a voting booth.
Ashley, thank you so much for the call. And it's, as you said, Zoe, earlier, it's awful that we even have to think about these things. And I think that in the abstract, we've all known for a long time that in theory they can happen anywhere. But the concrete list of locations is getting longer and longer. Yoga studios, I'm thinking of the movie theater in Aurora in 2012.
Totally, yeah. And to Ashley's point, yeah, it's like I felt that way for a long time about going to the movies, you know, speaking of what you're saying about Aurora, you know, if anyone stands up or walks across the screen in the middle of a film, I'm immediately on edge. It happened this weekend. I was at The Hate U Give, and some two kids got up and kind of ran across the screen, and I looked over very tense. And I remember 3 years ago, I saw Zoolander 2, which was not a memorable movie at all, but I still remember that night very clearly. It was me and my friend, and a man three rows in front of us was kind of older and alone and acting oddly, like a little off. And I just remember that movie so well because I was thinking, you know, is this it? Is this guy going to shoot up Zoolander 2 right now and this is going to be the end? You know, it's just scary.
Zoe, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you, Callum.
That's Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell. I want to bring in a couple of new voices to the conversation. Joining us on the line now from Normal, Illinois, is Professor Julie Weber. She teaches politics and government at Illinois State University. She's also the author of Failure to Hold, The Politics of School Violence, and Beyond Columbine, School Violence and the Virtual. Hello, Professor Weber.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Dante Ramos, the ideas editor for the Boston Globe. Hello, Dante.
Hi, great to be here.
Dante, let me start with you. As Zoe was just saying, you know, when we think about these mass shootings, we've seen them happen at concerts. We've seen them in churches, bars, nightclubs, movie theaters. How do you see that affecting our civil society?
I think all the evidence suggests that people really want to be together. You know, people want to see other people in live settings. We all, or at least many of us, for those of us who have jobs that end up sitting, you know, have us sitting behind computers all day. At the end of the day, you want to go out and see other people. You know, it's sort of a basic human desire. And and you even see in sort of war-torn countries like Iraq and Syria, there are still people who go to the marketplace. There are still people who go to houses of worship because they have to. There are reasons that take you out in the public sphere. So I don't think fundamentally that these incidents change that. But I do think, as your caller and your producer pointed out, that it does add to the list of things working against people gathering it in the public sphere. It gives people one more reason to try to interact with people only online rather than in person. And I don't think the evidence suggests that people interacting only online is good for our society.
Professor Weber, why have these places become the targets for shooters? What makes them vulnerable? And is it the very fact that we come there for a sense of community that they are the ideal place to disrupt that sentiment?
I think that's true. I think all of these spaces are spaces of civil society, spaces where people meet and assemble freely. And they come to see other people, as Mr. Ramos said, in person. You know, they don't want to be online all the time. So they are spaces of civil society, which is part of what makes what we call a nation state stable. They keep people happy, and they let us know that the wheels are turning correctly on a country, that we have a civil society. So the fact that they're being attacked and people don't feel safe in them, I think is very problematic for how we feel about the health of our democracy and how we feel about the health of our country.
Professor Weber, do you see people gathering in those real-world public spaces as they used to, or are we retreating to some degree into our virtual social worlds?
I think many people are retreating, and I think that that's been in some ways sped up by the privatization of what were formerly public spaces throughout the country. So you have, you know, for example, we still go out to sporting events, but the stadiums are owned by corporations, right? And so since we've, as a society, decided to change from public ownership and public use, we've changed to private ownership and private, in some ways, use of many what were formerly public spaces. And so there's less and less of them, and people get less and less practice for being out in them, and they have to be in them in a certain way. I think that's not the traditional way we thought about it under a more public-oriented civil society.
Let's hear from another listener. Matthew is calling from Whitman. Matthew, I understand that despite all these awful headlines, you feel like we just can't allow ourselves to be afraid to go out in public.
Yeah, I think if, first of all, thank you for taking my call. I think if people start staying in or start hiding, it's going to make basically the bad guy the bad guys win. I think we need to all come together and stop fighting. It doesn't matter what race you are, Democrat, Republican. We're Americans. We need to come together and solve this big issue that we're having. And I think we need to focus more on the mental health situation. There's not a lot of help out there, and there's not a lot of programs out there, I think, for mental health people. And I just think that's a big issue versus putting more laws into place for guns. I mean, there's already a good amount of laws, and they're pretty good laws. And I think we need to get, I think we're kind of stuck on that topic. I think we need to kind of move off that and start focusing on, like I said, the mental health point of view of it.
Matthew, thank you very much for the call. Dante, something Matthew just said struck me. You know, he says, you know, race doesn't matter, but we have seen in some of these mass shootings, sometimes it does. I'm thinking of the shooting at the African-American church in Charleston recently. And of course, we just had that awful shooting less than 2 weeks ago in Pittsburgh that was motivated by anti-Semitism. And yet, on the other hand, some of these shootings, like the most recent one, do seem to be sort of indiscriminate. And I'm wondering whether there's something about these shootings that perhaps can amplify our sense of empathy for one another. I mean, I think we have to be mindful of the fact that, you know, while maybe everyone right now is feeling like it's unsafe to go out into certain public spaces, there are folks, Dante, who are members of historically marginalized groups who have for a long time felt uncomfortable in certain public spaces just because of their identities.
In the aftermath of incidents like these, I think you do see a reaction, as you did after the shooting in South Carolina at the African American church, of people coming out and expressing solidarity and coming forth as a community. Similarly, after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, it was something that across the country, shot through the. LGBT community like a bolt of lightning. And, it does sort of create this sense of solidarity. But I think you're right that, if a community feels marginalized already, the existence of these kinds of threats isn't going to make them feel better about the state of society. Just to go back to one thing that the caller said, you know, talking about the difference between laws around guns and mental health, I'm not sure that it necessarily is an either or. And I think that, there's this weird ritual that we are unfortunately evolving where some very disturbed people with relatively easy access to weapons engage in these acts of performative violence. And sometimes it's motivated by race or anti-Semitism or homophobia, or sometimes it's a crazy person wanting to get attention and go out with a blaze of glory. But there's this, you know, this kind of negative vortex that we have created here where, these events happen and they tend to ricochet out into society.
Let's take one more call. Carrie is phoning in from the Back Bay with, I think, a very important question about, Carrie, how on earth do we talk to our children about this? How are you thinking about that right now?
I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. I remember having a fear of skinheads, and that's because there had been an incident where some skinheads had beaten an Ethiopian refugee, I believe, with a baseball bat. And so I just remember going about like my childhood and teen years being afraid whenever I saw skinheads, thinking they might want to beat me with a baseball bat and having that fear. And now I feel like the new normal is, you know, having a fear of massacres. And when I walk around with my kids, I mean, I left the site of the Boston Marathon bombing an hour before it happened. And I was going to take my kids there. And now everywhere I go, wherever there's you hear a mass shooting in the news, like coffee shops or concerts or playgrounds, the visual of a shooting crosses my mind. And my husband, will tell me, you shouldn't walk around being afraid, but I still have that visual because as like the mother bear, I want to protect my kids.
Of course.
So I want to heard that these things are like car accidents. You know, you hope it doesn't happen to you, but they happen. And that's how I, plan on talking to my kids about it.
Carrie, thank you so much for adding to our conversation. And thank you also to our guests, Professor Julie Weber. She's the author of Failure to Hold, The Politics of School Violence. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Our thanks also to Dante Ramos, the ideas editor for the Boston Globe.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Eric Fernstrom, the longtime top aide for Mitt Romney, joins us. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Mitt Romney was one of the most prominent never-Trump Republicans of the 2016 campaign. In March of that year, he delivered a speech pleading with his party not to nominate the billionaire. Here's how he described Trump's personal qualities.
The bullying, the greed, the showing off, the misogyny, the absurd third-grade theatrics.
So, will Romney continue to be critical of the president now that he's headed to the U.S. Senate? To answer that, we turn to Eric Fernstrom. Fernstrom was Romney's communications director during his successful 2002 campaign for governor of Massachusetts. He also served as a top aide and strategist for Romney in both the 2012 and 2008 presidential campaigns. And he joins us now. Eric, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with sort of a real basic question about your former candidate in Mitt Romney. He's been waiting a long time to be in the Senate. Of course, he's had some races in between, but 1994 was the first time around. Now in 2018, he's going to get his shot. What kind of senator do you expect Mitt Romney to be?
Well, you know, Mitt's an interesting political figure. He's got roots in three states. He was born in Michigan. He ran the Olympics in Utah. And, of course, he raised his family and he started a business in Massachusetts. And when he started his political career, he chose the hardest place of all to run and win as a Republican, and that's right here in Massachusetts. So now he's found success in the easiest place for him to run and win as a Republican, as the next senator from Utah. I think he's going to be a great addition to the Senate. You know, we're familiar with his leadership here in Massachusetts. He is a statesmanlike leader. He's gracious. He's courteous. He's bipartisan. I think we're going to need more people like him in politics.
You mentioned that it's an easy state. It's obviously a very red state, but it's also not really Trump country. I mean, he did win it in the general, but in the primary, Utah voters didn't really embrace Donald Trump, and Mitt Romney didn't either during the campaign. I want to remind listeners of something that Mitt Romney said when he was delivering a speech during the 2016 campaign, when he was extremely critical of Donald Trump.
Here's what I know. Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud. His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University.
But as you recall, Eric, after that, when Donald Trump was elected, Mitt Romney was a candidate for Secretary of State and seemed to be on friendlier terms with the president. So what should we expect? I mean, will we see a very critical Mitt Romney in the Senate, or will he be warmer to President Trump?
Well, I think Mitt Romney has demonstrated that he'll support Trump when he thinks he's right, and he's going to oppose him when he's wrong. He agrees broadly with Trump on things like tax policy and deregulation, but he's obviously uncomfortable with some of the things that Trump says and how he says them, and he's pointed that out. Yesterday, he was one of the first members of the Senate. Of course, he's senator-elect at this stage. To express some concern about the abrupt dismissal or resignation of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General and what that means for the Mueller investigation. And he wants to protect the integrity of that investigation so it can conclude unimpeded. So, you know, I think as a senator, his first priority will be making progress for the state of Utah and the nation, and that's going to guide his actions. But those who want him to be a constant thorn in the president's side, I think, are going to be disappointed. He's going to be his own person. He'll speak up when he needs to, and he'll support the president when he thinks he's doing the right thing.
Eric, in the past, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that legislation to protect the Mueller investigation that you mentioned a moment ago is unnecessary. He doesn't see any indication that the president would actually move to end that investigation. I'm curious whether you anticipate that, beyond supporting the continuation of the investigation, whether future Senator Romney might actually push McConnell to pass such legislation to protect that investigation.
Well, I actually think the next shoe to fall in this Mueller investigation will be a report from the special prosecutor himself, outlining his findings and any remaining indictments that may issue as a result of that. In an ironic sort of way, I think Jeff Sessions being shown the door is actually inviting more congressional scrutiny of what's happening in the Justice Department, particularly with respect to the Mueller investigation. And I find it very hard to believe that any new appointee of the president's is going to be confirmed without some kind of guarantee that the Mueller investigation will be allowed to proceed and come to its natural end.
Just before the Sessions resignation yesterday, the president had a rather combative news conference with journalists. And Eric, I'd love to get your take on that because you've kind of been on both sides. You're a former reporter. I think you spent a decade at the Boston Herald here, right? And but you've also been a media strategist for political candidates. And I think it's hard to deny that the president's anti-media posture has been effective for him in a lot of ways. So how do you view that exchange?
Well, I thought the whole press conference was classic Trump. There were hostile exchanges with reporters. The president was threatening his political opponents. He was shaming Republicans who ran and lost for not embracing him more fully. But this is what we've come to expect of our president. I know that's sad in a way. I think Trump has a way of bringing out the worst in people. And you could almost predict how that press conference was going to go once Trump moved off his prepared remarks and started taking questions and answering them extemporaneously. Why, for instance, would he even call on Jim Acosta, given the bad relationship that exists between the two? I think it's because he actually enjoys the back and forth, the hostility of the exchange. I think in some way he derives energy from that. But what happened yesterday at the White House will delight his supporters. It horrifies his detractors. But I think long-term what it does is damaging to the health of our policymaking generally, because now I think people are becoming accustomed to looking to Washington for their entertainment and not for serious policymaking. And I think that has major ramifications for us as a country going forward.
If Eric Trump brings out the worst in the press, what does he bring out among fellow Republicans? How do you see the party right now? I mean, is it fully the party of Donald Trump, or is it not quite that far? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, we just saw Charlie Baker win re-election here in Massachusetts as a decidedly different type of Republican. So what is the state of the GOP right now in your view?
Well, let's talk about the midterm election of a couple of days ago. You know, I think Democrats were hoping for a wave. It wasn't a wave, but they did recapture the House, and that's a significant achievement. But there was much more of a mixed result because they didn't get the Senate. In fact, the Republicans increased their majority in the Senate. And I think of those senators who, Republican senators who are newly elected, I think they really owe their success to the president coming into their states, campaigning for them. So they're going to be more Trumpier. And even in the House, although the Republican conference there is smaller now, I think that, too, is more Trumpier. So Donald Trump owns the Republican Party, lock, stock, and barrel. And you can even say that his support, not only among Republicans, but among voters of all types, is flourishing in some parts of the country. And I think that's much to the dismay of the party's never-Trumpers and, of course, for Democrats who are hoping through this midterm election to drive a stake through the heart of the president, and that just did not happen.
Eric, do you see a lane in 2020 for a different kind of Republican to challenge the president? Perhaps not for the party's nomination. It's hard to imagine that. But maybe as an independent, I'm thinking of a Michael Bloomberg or a Jeff Flake or even, you know, a certain future senator from Utah, perhaps.
No, I don't see anybody successfully taking on Trump in a primary challenge for president in 2020. You know, both parties are undergoing transformations. I think the Republican Party is further along than the Democrats in the sense that they've moved away from the center and they've become much more conservative with Trump as their champion. The Democrats are catching up, though. they too are moving further and further out to the left. So what does that mean? I think it means two things. Number one, it's likely that the Democrats are going to choose as their next nominee someone who is more ideological, younger, possibly a minority. This would resemble the changes that are taking place in the party nationally. For the Republicans and the Democrats as a whole, I think it also could possibly open the door to a viable third party that is centrist and more moderate in its politics. But anybody who thinks that Trump is somehow vulnerable to an intra-party challenge, I think, is underestimating the hold he currently has on the party.
Do you think Mitt Romney has any appetite for another White House bid, or is he done with that?
I think Mitt is entirely focused on being the next senator from Utah and putting together his team and settling into his new office.
It seems that 70 is the new 40 or 50 in these presidential races. So I guess maybe we'll never know. I was following, Eric, your commentary on election night on Tuesday on Twitter, and I took interest in some of what you said about Elizabeth Warren's win here in Massachusetts. Yes, she did handily defeat Jeff Deal, 60% to 36%. But you've also said that the results might give Democrats some concern about her national prospects in 2020. What do you mean by that?
Well, Elizabeth Warren won, and that's good enough for another term in the Senate. But I think she underperformed here in Massachusetts. For instance, the Republican governor, Charlie Baker, got more votes than she did right here in a deep blue state. And I think what that signals is that she's not a dominating political force in her own backyard. So in the wake of the midterms, what are people talking about with respect to 2020? It's not Elizabeth Warren. It's a person like Beto O'Rourke in Texas, who, even though he lost his Senate race there against Ted Cruz, the reason he's generating his excitement is because he's young, he's dynamic, there's a newness about him, and he can run competitively in a state where Democrats are not expected to do well. I don't think anybody believes Warren could have performed the way Beto O'Rourke did in that Texas race against Ted Cruz, and I think they have some serious concerns about whether she could do as well in some must-win states for the Democrats like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. So there's an invisible primary that takes place, sort of a beauty contest. And one of the factors that people will look at is how you performed in your most recent election. And yes, she did win. And as I said, that's good enough for her reelection. But she didn't do as well as the Republican governor in a deep blue state. And I think that could be a sticking point for her going forward.
Yeah, the Republican governor, Charlie Baker, obviously fared very well, even as the Senate race kind of became an issue in that gubernatorial race. I'm thinking back to that debate on WGBH between Baker and his Democratic challenger, Jay Gonzalez, when Gonzalez tried to make Baker's support for the GOP ticket up and down the ticket a big issue and said, you should not be voting for this guy because he's endorsing Jeff Deal. Let's just take a listen to what he said at the time.
Governor, are you going to vote for Jeff Deal?
Governor?
I'm going to vote for me, and I'm going to vote for Karen Pulido, and I'm going to vote for a series of other candidates as well. I don't know what I'm going to do yet with respect to that one.
You don't know if you're going to vote for the guy you endorsed?
I haven't made a decision.
I should say that after that, Governor Baker sort of amended his statements, that he had misspoke, that he was going to support the ticket, but he certainly didn't really embrace Jeff Deal. And I know, Eric, you said earlier that Donald Trump owns the national GOP lock, stock, and barrel, but that doesn't seem to be the case here in Massachusetts. It seems like the Baker version of Republicanism trumps the Deal version of Republicanism. Is that your assessment at this point as well?
No, it's not. I believe Trump does own the Massachusetts Republican Party. I also believe that Charlie Baker was fortunate in that he did not draw a serious Trump-like candidate.
Eric, couldn't you say, though, that the governor did draw a Trump-like challenger in the primary? I mean, Scott Lively styled himself as very much a Trump Republican, and Baker trounced him.
Yeah, well, Scott Lively was not the ideal opponent for Baker in that primary because he had virtually no name recognition and he had no money to go out and buy it. I think a much more serious challenger, and people scoff at him, would have been somebody like Curt Schilling, who has 100% name recognition and is closely identified with the president on a lot of issues. That would have posed a real problem for Baker, but fortunately he did not have to face that, and he won his primary and won his general election.
What about Deal? Is he a serious contender in Massachusetts politics and in future elections?
Well, I think Deal's mistake was in not distancing himself from Trump. In some ways, I think a stronger candidate for that Senate seat would have been someone like Beth Lindstrom or even John Kingston, who were not shy about criticizing Trump when he deserved it. That type of candidate would have fared much better in a general election here in Massachusetts. But the paradox of our politics is that they could not get out of our Republican primary. That's why I'm telling you that even here in Massachusetts, where we sort of have always taken note of the fact that the Republican Party is more liberal or more moderate than the party nationally, even here, Trump really does have a lock on Republican primary politics.
Well, Eric, we really appreciate your insights into politics more broadly and Mitt Romney specifically. That is Eric Fernstrom, founder and a principal of the Shamit Group. He's a political consultant and a former longtime top aide to Mitt Romney. Eric, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo on his mission to make opera great again. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. That's the voice of countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo singing The Encounter by composer Philip Glass. Costanzo has been hailed by NPR as a countertenor for the 21st century, and he's made it his mission to make opera mainstream again. That's no easy task for a genre that has struggled to connect with contemporary audiences. But Costanzo believes that through collaborations with musicians, artists, filmmakers, and fashionistas, opera can reach anyone. He is Musical America's 2019 Vocalist of the Year, and he has a new album out, his first, entitled ARC. It melds the old-world compositions of George Frideric Handel with the more modern works of Philip Glass. Costanzo was in Boston this week with the Celebrity Series of Boston, and he joined me in the studio. Anthony, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, as a countertenor, and perhaps you can explain a little bit what that is, although I think our listeners got a clue hearing your musical introduction, you must have a somewhat limited selection of roles, right? Because you're singing in a register that we're more accustomed to hearing from female vocalists.
Totally, and you might be surprised hearing my speaking voice now after hearing that clip. It's a totally different register from the speaking voice, but we all have it. You know, men have falsetto voices, and essentially I'm just singing in a reinforced, trained falsetto, and it goes back to the Baroque times. When women weren't allowed to sing in church, opera's happening. And so what winds up going on, which is very strange, is men are castrated to keep their high voices so that they can sing really loud. Now, of course, this makes every man in any audience I talk to very uncomfortable when we discuss it. But it was an amazing phenomenon that launched opera into the public and made it super popular. And I think the fascination with that high adult male sound carries forward to like Michael Jackson, the Bee Gees, Prince, all of the people who sing high. And essentially, I'm doing that in the operatic form.
And you've skipped the surgical assistance, but my understanding is that there was actually some advantage that went with that. I've heard you talk about the more easily expanded rib cages of the castrati, right, that you don't have. Tell me about that sort of extra endurance challenge.
Absolutely. You know, they were different because their hormones were not the same as ours as adult males. So their bones didn't harden as much, and that meant they could expand their rib cages, and that's where your breath goes when you're breathing as a singer. So they could sing forever and ever and ever. whatever. This is the lore that we hear. So composers like Handel write these long, long lines, and that's a primary source. When we look at the music of Handel, we see these long lines that now I have to deal with as a non-castrated male.
So you have these old selections by Handel that you can sing, but there's a more limited selection of contemporary music written for the countertenor. And so my understanding is you've had to sort of forge your own path and be kind of an entrepreneur in the musical space. Fill us in.
Absolutely. I think as a soprano or a mezzo-soprano, tenor, bass, you can sing all the Puccini, Verdi, Tosca, La Bohème, all the things that, you know, are classic opera tunes. But as a countertenor, you really are relegated to this Baroque period or contemporary things like Philip Glass that have been written for countertenors. Or I poke composers with, you know, hot pokers and say, write me something. And so I've developed a whole repertoire of contemporary work, and I've found parallels between Handel and Glass, which is really interesting to me. They both use repetition to sort of plumb the depths of human psychology. And when I think about what I do as a human being, if I've got a crush on someone and they text me, I look at that text 10 times. That is our psychology. And so someone like Philip Glass takes that idea of repetition, and he repeats little chunks of the music over and over, and it enters your psyche and it becomes almost sort of meditative.
So part of your mission now is to deliver opera to the masses, to expand the appeal. How do you go about doing that?
I think it's all about interdisciplinary collaboration. I feel like our audiences are there. They just don't know that they would like opera, but they're people who like beautiful things, whether it's fashion, dance, art. I think that's where our gateway audience lies. So I try and give them a point of access by collaborating with all different artists across different disciplines and getting them to use opera in their work in some way or another so that the audience of a famous filmmaker might say, hey, I really like that music that was in that video of yours that I saw. What is it? And I think people are so intimidated by the language. It's in a different language. It's boring. It's a long format. And I think it's actually not as difficult as people think to relate to. They just need a way to get into it.
On the program last week, we heard some of a collaboration that you're sort of talking about between Freddie Mercury and an opera singer, Montserrat Caballé. Is that what you're talking about? Or are you even expanding beyond the vocal medium?
Absolutely. I love those kinds of collaborations. And I think that was an exposure for her, a very famous opera singer, to a whole new audience. And they must have thought, who is this woman? I want to go look at more clips of her on YouTube if that had existed back then. But that's the way it happens. And then you start to get engaged by the music itself. And I don't think the opera is for everyone. I don't think everyone will buy 20 tickets a year. But I do think it holds a sort of perspective on the human condition, which is really meaningful, really emotional, and can also be really fun.
So a prime example of exposing a new audience to opera is a video that you produced back in 2014 called Opera in the Bronx. And if you haven't seen it, it's a video in which you show up in a classroom of sixth graders, and how you approach the classroom really gets to the fundamentals of the craft. Let's take a listen.
When you feel sad, what do you do? Give me a sense of what that sounds like. Let me take that feeling and let me put that in the music. I want you to listen and see if this music can put you in touch with how that feels.
So what you see there is a little bit of initial snickering by some of the children, and then they get pretty serious, Anthony, and they're kind of into it. And as you see that reaction from the audience, what's going through your head?
A lot of things, but I see these kids as the litmus test for everyone else. I mean, if they get it and they get it so profoundly, yes, they laugh, they cover their ears, which I love because I'm a man singing with a woman's voice. It's weird, you know, and I love that novelty factor. So I invite them to laugh. But as they listen, and they listen more intently because they're sort of shocked by it, they get so engaged in it. And every single class I've done this for, there are always kids who cry, kids who are connecting to the emotion of their daily lives, the loss of a parent or the loss of a turtle, whatever it is. They have this inherent emotion, and this music brings it out in them, even when they don't know what the words mean, what the historical context is. So I see the primal power of the human voice, and I see it have an effect on these kids, and I think this can work for anyone.
You've said elsewhere that even with the gender fluidity of today, the shock value of seeing this man stand up and sing in a woman's voice hasn't worn off. It didn't wear off for those kids. But I'm curious whether you feel like this moment of gender fluidity, as you put it, actually does sort of expose a new audience or new opportunity for you.
It's amazing to me, that the younger kids that I meet now are so much less sensitive to this binary construction of what gender is. And though my voice is shocking just coming out of my body, it's a small body and it's a big voice, it's able to be accepted more readily and in a more welcoming way in these times than it was when I was younger.
So the new album, ARC, combines music, as you mentioned, from George Frideric Handel and Philip Glass. And this is obviously a very old classical composer and a more contemporary one. And I want to play one of the pieces from ARC. This is a Philip Glass selection. The song is called Liquid Days, which he originally composed in 1986. And the lyrics for this piece were written by David Byrne of the new wave band The Talking Heads. Let's take a listen to this one. So the accompanying video here really adds another layer to it as well. It shows a contemporary dancer alone under an overpass. And I think it really represents the epitome of what you're trying to do, if I understand your mission. And I'm curious if you can just tell us a little bit more about what that song means to you.
Absolutely. Well, it's a very funny song, in addition to being touching, making love a character and talking about how love needs a shave and love takes off its shoes and sits on the couch and crosses its legs. So it's abstract and also very narrative at the same time. And what we decided to do is make these music videos in classical music, I'd never seen something that felt like a pop music video. They all felt a little bit kind of staid to me, be in front of a velvet curtain or with a glammed up opera singer. So I said to these filmmakers and artists, Oscar winners, this one was made by Mark Romanek, who's directed Beyoncé and Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson and Madonna, anyone you ask. And we said to these people, make whatever occurs to you from this music. And what they've done with it, in all these different cases, we're releasing 9 of these videos, and you can watch them, really illuminates the music from a different visual perspective, and it tells a story. Even Tilda Swinton, the famous actress, made a video of one of the Handel arias with all of her dogs on the beach, and it's gotten a lot of play because it's so joyous to see the dogs jumping and running and almost doing choreography to this opera. So there are fun, serious, and touching ways that all of these songs have been interpreted and reinterpreted.
Yeah, the dog video is mesmerizing. And it's exactly what people need when they need a little lift me up. But I'm curious what the response is within your classical community. I mean, do you get complaints and pushback from people saying, you know, we realize you want to appeal to new people, Anthony, but, you know, the art form is the art form and, you know, you're straying too far?
I've gotten surprisingly little pushback, although I'm sure it's there and I don't hear enough of it. But I think it's great if I can create controversy and push people's buttons and push the envelope. I think fundamentally what we're all excited about is keeping the tradition at its core alive. It's not that I'm changing the way I sing. It's not that I'm changing anything Handel or Philip Glass wrote. I'm just giving it a new lens through which to be seen. And so in that sense, it's not so transgressive, but hopefully just creative.
I should mention that the dog video that we're talking about is available for your viewing pleasure on our website at radioboston.org. And as you mentioned, it was directed by Tilda Swinton and her partner, Sandro Kopp. And it really is just a joy to watch. But in the absence of being able to watch it live right now, let's just take a little listen. So as you're listening, just picture the Springer Spaniels frolicking in the water and jumping around on the beach. So as you look ahead, what does the future of opera look like in your mind? Or perhaps compare that to where you think it's going on its own track and where you might have to redirect it a little bit.
That's a great question. I feel like opera has to reinvent itself a little bit, but that doesn't mean erasing what it is, because there's so much to love about it. The reinventions of opera need to happen in new spaces with new collaborators so that the art form itself takes on a different patina and it enters the zeitgeist. And I think once people are exposed to those more novel interpretations of the music around the fringe, then it takes them back to the core and the traditional things, which our cultivated taste, that's for sure. But once you have an in and a way to love it, it's much easier to approach.
That is Anthony Roth Costanzo, a countertenor, and his new album is called ARC. And for more information and to view some of those joyous videos that we were just talking about, you can visit our website, radioboston.org. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.